Hey guys, how's it going? Welcome back to the show. Back to it from yesterday or whatever, if you heard it the other day. Welcome back to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton. It's libertarian foreign policy mostly, which means I'm against it. And mostly what I attempt to do, I do a pretty damn good job of it. I debunk the lies that the war party uses to justify all the horrible things that they do, because there are no good, honest reasons for the war party to do the things they do, only dishonest ones. So they make my job pretty easy, really. I just listen to what they say, and then I point out the obvious lies and omissions. Yeah, that's basically the deal. And, yeah, I don't know. From time to time, people say, wow, I never heard anybody anti-war just outright saying, no, you know, F you, I'm right, you're wrong kind of thing. Usually anti-war means, oh, pro-peace, man, let's all get along and stink like patchouli and not actually know what we're talking about. Well, no offense to you hippies out there. No, I don't really believe in all that give peace a chance and this and that kind of new communist man who is no longer a selfish, greedy bastard or whatever. I don't believe in utopia. I'm just trying to oppose the worst of what mankind is up to right now, and virtually all of it is centered in Washington, D.C. And, of course, there's the reactions to that, but otherwise, you know, the world is a pretty peaceful place, other than America's worst right now. Do you realize that? This is one of the most peaceful eras in all of human history, for now. Boy, I shouldn't even say that. That sound like famous last words before the H-bombs start going off. Well, we'll see. Anyway, today's show, I don't know, man, doesn't look like we're going to have any guests, because they all said they want to do the show tomorrow, not today. So we got a good show lined up for you tomorrow. And you know, today too, but it's just going to be me complaining about stuff. And, you know, reading the news to you. This and that kind of thing. Yeah. It's primarily an interview show, but I interview myself from time to time, too. All right, here. So, housekeeping stuff. My website is scotthorton.org. Horton, like, is faithful 100%. Here's a who and all that stuff. Scotthorton.org. And you can find all my interview archives there. There's more than 3,500 of them, more than 3,600 of them now, maybe 3,700, I don't know, going back to 2003, proving that I've always been right about everything. And, well, I mean, the proof is in the questions. You get it. And the whole show archives there go back to at least, I don't know, 2010 or something. I used to be much more hesitant about publishing the whole show archives every day. I kind of wish I hadn't. Kind of wish I had all those going back all the way, too. And I guess I have most of them, but you don't. But on the website, you can find a whole hell of a lot of audio for free. It's all for free. ScottHorton.org. And my God, man, join up the chat room. Where is everybody? We got about a half our usual crew in the chat room today. Hey, guys, how's it going? I'm trying to send some more people your way right now. It's scotthorton.org/chat. All you need is Chrome or Mozilla or even Internet Explorer. Just go to scotthorton.org/chat. You don't need a pigeon. You don't need a Chatzilla. You don't need XChat. You don't need any of those extra things that your boss will not let you download onto his computer. All you need is a plain old browser. scotthorton.org/chat. Put in a fake name and a CAPTCHA and you're in there. And if you're into Chatzilla and XChat and all those things, and you like to do the IRC free node chat stuff, then yeah, that too. Hashtag Scott Horton Show. Same chat room. Hashtag Scott Horton Show on the IRC free node thing. And people have tried to clarify for me before what is free node and what is IRC and what is this and that. I think the IRC is like HTTP, IRC instead, something kind of protocol sort of thing. But then, so what does that make free node? I don't know. But if you know, then all you need to know is hashtag Scott Horton Show. You can join up the chat room. All right, good. And then, hey, man, follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. When I'm not on the radio, I'm basically complaining on Twitter all damn day. And retweeting other good stuff. Bad news, and so forth. So, I quit Facebook, man. Right about a year ago, I quit Facebook. And I'm pretty happy about that. Too much Twitter as it is. I don't know what I would do if I had to keep up with them both all the time anymore. But they quit showing my posts to anyone, so why would I continue putting my posts on there? Nice algorithm, guys. Screw your crappy, stupid website that I hate. And you know what else I hate about Facebook? When I'm trying to read something, and it automatically updates my feed and pushes the thing I'm trying to read all the way down there where I can't get to it anymore. Twitter doesn't do that. On Twitter, you click, yeah, show me more stuff, and then it shows you more stuff. It doesn't ruin what you're looking at when you're in the middle of looking at it. That's another thing I hate about Facebook. Anyway, Facebook sucks. I'm not on there anymore. I mean, you can find it facebook.com/Scott Horton Show, but there's nothing on there anymore. Or nothing new. But I am on Twitter all damn day, every day. And, boy, pick a fight with me about Rand Paul, and I'll fight with you. If you want. That's twitter.com/Scott Horton Show. And now, one more thing, and I've been meaning to tell you this over and over again, and apologies to Ian Freeman. Oh, first, apologies to Ernie Hancock. I was supposed to be on Ernie's show this morning. I was unable to do it. And so, sorry, Ernie. I'll get back with you and the wife and work something out to come on soon enough, I promise. But very sorry for leaving you hanging this morning. I hope you found another guest on short notice. Okay, now apologies to Ian Freeman, because Ian Freeman, here's a guy who, he runs the Liberty Radio Network, and he lets me have a spot on it. I'm very grateful for that, and he has asked the hosts to help promote this thing, and I hadn't gotten around to it yet, but it's a very important thing. I'm really excited about it, and I hope that you guys will, help out and participate in this. He says, check out the details on the fundraising page at africa.lrn.fm, africa.lrn.fm, or watch the video there for more information about what's happening. The short version, our satellite provider gave us a few years for free over Africa. Then they pulled the plug. Ian writes, I'd really like to get those listeners back. We were having an effect there. And the longer LRN is available, the more people we can reach. If you can promote the fundraiser link or the video link to your audience, it would help your show and others on the network reach new ears globally. As you know, LRN.fm is a labor of love for Ian. It costs him thousands of years every year, thousands of dollars every year. Thousands of years, is that what I said? Thousands of dollars every year to operate. And so he just needs to help out. And this is a thing he's told me before. Man, I get contacts from people in Africa saying they love your show. And I'm going, really? And he's saying, yeah. And apparently, because of this satellite, I don't know if it was a few big ones or a bunch of little ones or what, but apparently all from east to west across sub-Saharan Africa, which I know is huge, I guess. I don't know how far south any of these stations were, but you know, right in there between Nigeria and Somalia, you could hear this show. So I guess that includes Chad and, hell, I don't even want to guess what all countries that counts. We had apparently a ton of listeners in Africa on this satellite. And so Ian, I think, quite rightly, is determined to get back on there so he can help promote libertarianism to Africans. And it's maybe a good way for me to try to warn them about the American special forces coming to kill them and take their things away, as per Nick Turse's great journalism. But anyway, music's playing. Got to go right back with a bunch of bad news for you on the Scott Horton Show in just a minute. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, guys, welcome back. Girls, too. I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on Liberty Radio Network. Man, so much stuff to talk about. Don't guess I'll get through even most of it today, but we'll see what we can do here. The first thing is the Wall Street Journal. Israel spied on Iran talks. Allies snooping upset White House because information was used to lobby Congress to try to sink the Iran nuclear deal, by Adam Entwistle, again, at Wall Street Journal, WSJ.com. By the way, here's a trick. If you ever get angry because you can't read a Wall Street Journal article, what you do is put the title into, you know, they'll show you like a splash page, but you can't read the whole article. Take the title, put it in Google News, and then hover over it. You got to wait till it changes from the WSJ link. If you hover over for just a second, it'll change to a google.com/a-million-little-characters/WSJ link. Blam, you get right in past the paywall. That's how you read the Wall Street Journal without signing up. Okay, Israel spied on Iran talks. Soon after the U.S. and other major powers entered negotiations last year to curtail Iran's nuclear program, senior White House officials learned Israel was spying on the closed-door talks. The spying operation was part of a broader campaign by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government to penetrate the negotiations and then help build a case against the emerging terms of the deal, current and former U.S. officials said. In addition to eavesdropping, Israel acquired information from confidential U.S. briefings, informants, and diplomatic contacts in Europe, the officials said. The espionage didn't upset... Now, look, here's the first story broken in here. The White House handed this story over to the Wall Street Journal, right? This isn't some whistleblowing. This ain't the kind of leak that'll get you in trouble. This is Obama and the National Security Council decided we want to put this in the Wall Street Journal. That's why this story exists today, just so we're clear about that. It's, I think, pretty obvious. The espionage didn't upset the White House as much as Israel's sharing of inside information with U.S. lawmakers and others to drain support from a high-stakes deal intended to limit Iran's nuclear program. Quote, it's one thing for the U.S. and Israel to spy on each other. It's another thing for Israel to steal U.S. secrets and play them back to U.S. legislators to undermine U.S. diplomacy, said a senior U.S. official briefed on the matter. The U.S. and Israel, and you know, I'm kind of torn about that because it seems to me that all legislative powers reside in the Congress, and all this stuff about how foreign policy wholly and totally belongs to the president, I don't agree with. Now, that doesn't mean that the Iran letter was correct, that any executive agreement amounts to a treaty and must be quote-unquote ratified by the Senate. Not really ratified, but, you know, they must provide their advice and consent on every last international agreement. But you got to admit, it sounds kind of funny that, oh, we're not really mad at them spying on us. We're just mad at them telling Congress, the U.S. Congress, what the actual facts of the matter are, or, you know, with their spin on them anyway. Then on the other hand, the U.S. Congress is almost wholly and completely owned by the Israel lobby, and they're a bunch of treacherous traitors, and they would do anything to serve the interests of Likud over the interests of the United States of America, never mind Barack Obama and his crappy Democratic Party. All right. Anyway. Back to the story here. It's one thing for the U.S. and Israel to spy on each other. It's another thing for Israel to steal U.S. secrets and play them back to U.S. legislators to undermine U.S. diplomacy. The U.S., quote-unquote, said an official. The U.S. and Israel, longtime allies who routinely swap information on security threats, sometimes operate behind the scenes like spy versus spy rivals. The White House has largely tolerated Israeli snooping on U.S. policymakers, a posture Israel takes when the tables are turned. Yeah, well, according to Edward Snowden's documents, the executive branch of this country, the NSA, turns over their entire cash to the Israelis every day and only asks them nicely, please don't blackmail our congressmen with any of this stuff. Please don't look at any of this stuff that you shouldn't be looking at in there. They turn over their entire hall. I know it didn't make the New York Times, but it was in the Guardian. Anyway, the White House discovered the operation, in fact, when U.S. intelligence agencies spying on Israel intercepted communications among Israeli officials that carry details the U.S. believe could have only come from access to confidential talks, officials briefed on the matter said. Israeli officials denied spying on U.S. negotiators and said they received their information through other means, including close surveillance of Iranian leaders receiving the latest U.S. and European offers. European officials, particularly the French, also have been more transparent with Israel about the closed-door discussions than the Americans, Israeli and U.S. officials said. Netanyahu and Israeli Ambassador Ron Dermer early this year saw a rapidly closing window to increase pressure on Obama before a key deadline at the end of March, Israeli officials said. Using levers of political influence unique to Israel, Mr. Netanyahu and Dermer calculated that a lobbying campaign in Congress before an announcement was made would improve the chances of killing or reshaping any deal. They knew the information would damage relations with the White House, Israeli officials said, but decided that was an acceptable cost. The campaign may not have worked as well as hoped, Israeli officials now say, because it ended up alienating many congressional Democrats whose support Israel was counting on to block a deal. Obama administration officials, departing from their usual description of the unbreakable bond between the U.S. and Israel, have voiced sharp criticisms of Netanyahu and Dermer to describe how the relationship has changed. Quote, people feel personally sold out, a senior administration official said. That's where the Israelis really better be careful, because a lot of these people will not only be around for this administration, but probably, or possibly the next one as well. No, Jeb is next. Don't be stupid. He's not keeping the Democrats. This account of the Israeli campaign is based on interviews with more than a dozen current and former U.S. and Israeli diplomats, intelligence officials, policymakers, and lawmakers. Distrust between Netanyahu and Obama has been growing for years, but worsened when Obama launched secret talks with Iran in 2012. The president didn't tell Mr. Netanyahu because of concerns about leaks, helping set the stage for the current standoff. According to the blah, 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 officials, U.S. officials said Israel has long topped the list of countries that aggressively spy on the U.S., along with China, Russia, and France. The U.S. expends more counterintelligence resources fending off Israeli spy operations than any other close ally, U.S. officials said. A senior official in the Prime Minister's office said Monday, quote, these allegations are utterly false. The state of Israel, denial and whatever. Current and former Israeli officials said their intelligence agencies scaled back their targeting of U.S. officials. That's such a lie. Read Jeff Stein. Ask Phil Giraldi about any of this. That's ridiculous. I'm not going to, you know, insult you by reading Israeli denials that they spy on the United States. Give me a break. While U.S. officials, and then give all of our best technology to the Chinese for a song. While U.S. officials may not be direct targets, current and former officials said Israeli intelligence agencies sweep up communications between U.S. officials and parties targeted by Israelis, including Iran. Americans shouldn't be surprised, said a person familiar with the Israeli practice, since U.S. intelligence agencies help the Israelis build a system to listen in on high-level Iranian communications. As secret talks with Iran progressed into 2013, U.S. intelligence agencies monitored Israel's communications to see if the country knew of the negotiations. Obama didn't tell Netanyahu until September 2013. Hey! I didn't hear any bumper music, did you? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy.
Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back. Sorry, man, I didn't hear the bumper music telling me that I had to shut up. So, sorry for the abrupt ending for that last segment there. Anyway, Wall Street Journal, Israel spied on Iran talks. As secret talks with Iran progressed into 2013, U.S. intelligence agencies monitored Israel's communications to see if they knew of the negotiations. Israeli officials, who said they already learned about the talks through their own channels, told their U.S. counterparts they were upset about being excluded. Did the administration really believe we wouldn't find out? Israeli officials said, according to a former U.S. official. The episode cemented Netanyahu's concern that Obama was bent on clinching a deal with Iran, whether or not it served Israel's best interest. Israeli officials said. Obama administration officials said the president was committed to preventing Iran from developing nuclear weapons. Mr. Dermer started lobbying U.S. lawmakers just before the U.S. and other powers signed an interim agreement with Iran in November 2013. Mr. Netanyahu and Dermer went to Congress after seeing they had little influence on the White House. Before the interim deal was made, Dermer gave lawmakers Israel's analysis. The U.S. offer would dramatically undermine economic sanctions on Iran, according to congressional officials who took part in the briefings. After learning about the briefings, the White House dispatched senior officials to counter Mr. Dermer. The officials told lawmakers that Israel's analysis exaggerated the sanctions relief by as much as 10 times, meeting participants said. Remember that? And they were going, oh, you're going to give them $40 billion or something, whatever. Yeah, you're lying, as always. When the next round of negotiations with Iran, and it was their money anyway, that was seized and stolen by Uncle Sam the thief. When the next round of negotiations with Iran started in Switzerland last year, U.S. counterintelligence agents told members of the U.S. negotiating team that Israel would likely try to penetrate their communications, a senior Obama administration official said. The U.S. routinely shares information with its European counterparts and others to coordinate negotiating positions. While U.S. intelligence officials believe secure U.S. communications are relatively safe from the Israelis, they say European communications are vulnerable. Netanyahu and his top advisors received confidential updates on the Geneva talks from Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Wendy Sherman and other U.S. officials who knew at the time that Israeli intelligence was working to fill in any gaps. The White House eventually curtailed the briefings, U.S. officials said, withholding sensitive information for fear of leaks. Current and former Israeli officials said their intelligence... And let me just say here before, because I probably will forget to get back to this in a minute, that it makes sense... And it's fair for the government to use secrecy in the middle of negotiations, as Reza Marashi, former State Department official and now with NIAC, has explained on the show. When you're in the middle of a negotiation, one little piece out of context leaked to the media or to a foreign government or to whoever could be enough to scuttle the negotiations, even if it's actually not accurate out of context. You might... take one position in, on one day in a negotiation just to set up to be able to change the position a little bit in 2 weeks or what have you. So the whole thing is kind of conditional upon, not updating the global public of every last if and or but during the negotiations. If all negotiations between rival nation states had to be public the whole time, then no one would ever successfully negotiate anything. And I guess we'd all die in a war. Current and former Israeli officials said their intelligence agencies can get much of the information they seek by targeting Iranians and others in the region who are communicating with countries in the talks. In November, the Israelis learned that contents of a proposed deal offered by the U.S. but ultimately rejected by Iran, U.S. and Israeli... Huh? I screwed up something there. In November, the Israelis learned the contents of a proposed deal offered by the U.S., but ultimately rejected by Iran, U.S. and Israeli officials said. Israeli officials told their U.S. counterparts the terms offered insufficient protections. U.S. officials urged the Israelis to give the negotiations a chance, but Netanyahu's top advisors concluded the emerging deal was unacceptable. The White House was making too many concessions, while the Iranians were holding firm, Israeli officials said. Obama administration officials reject that view, saying Israel was making impossible demands that Iran would never accept. The president has made clear time and again that no deal is better than a bad deal, a senior administration official said. In January, Mr. Netanyahu, why do they keep calling him Mr. Netanyahu? He's just Netanyahu, okay? He's not Bibi either. He's Benjamin, the child killer liar. That's who he is. In January, Netanyahu told the White House his government intended to oppose the Iran deal, but didn't explain how. On January 21st, Boehner announced Netanyahu would address Congress. Yeah, anyway, I think I can finish with this. Well, see, I'm not sure if I'm missing anything. Yeah, I'm going to keep going. The same day, Dermer and other Israeli officials visited Capitol Hill to brief lawmakers and aides seeking a bipartisan coalition large enough to block or amend any deal. Most Republicans were already prepared to challenge the White House on the negotiations, so Dermer focused on the Democrats. The deal is bad, he said in one briefing. A spokesman for the Israeli, meaning they're going to have any centrifuges at all. Yeah, okay. How are you going to make them get rid of them? With magic? A spokesman for the Israeli embassy in Washington, Aaron Segui, I guess, said Mr. Dermer did not launch a special campaign on January 21st. Dermer, the spokesperson, said, has consistently briefed both Republicans and Democrats, senators and congressmen, on Israel's concerns. Dermer and other Israeli officials over the following weeks gave lawmakers and their aides information the White House was trying to keep secret, including how the emerging deal could allow Iran to operate around 6,500 centrifuges, devices used to process nuclear material. The Israeli officials told lawmakers that Iran would also be permitted to deploy advanced IR-4 centrifuges that could process fuel on a larger scale, meeting participants and administration officials said. Israeli officials said such fuel, which under the emerging deal would be intended for energy plants, could be used to one day build nuclear bombs. The information, which is not correct, the information in the briefings, Israeli officials said, was widely known among the countries participating in the negotiations. So I don't think they're going to mention it here, so I'm going to mention it, that it was in the news last week that Netanyahu tried to prevent Mossad from briefing Congress. And it wasn't until Republican Senator Corker objected, who was Netanyahu's, you know, biggest bitch on the whole Hill. He said, well, wait a minute, you want to prevent Mossad from... No, we want to hear from Mossad. And Mossad came up there and contradicted Netanyahu and told the congressman the truth about it, which was why Netanyahu tried to stop them. Imagine that. When asked in February during one briefing where Israel got its inside information, Israeli officials said their sources included the French and the British governments as well as their own intelligence, according to people there. Dermer never shared confidential intelligence information with members of Congress. His briefings did not include specific details from the negotiations, etc., said the Israeli source. Current and former U.S. officials confirmed that the number and type of centrifuges cited in the briefings were part of the discussions, but they said the briefings were misleading because Israeli officials didn't disclose the concessions asked of Iran. Those included giving up stockpiles of nuclear material as well as modifying the advanced centrifuges to slow output, these officials said. Administration didn't brief lawmakers on the centrifuge numbers and other details at the time because the information was classified and the details were still in flux, current and former U.S. officials said. The congressional briefings and Netanyahu's decision to address a joint meeting of Congress on the emerging deal sparked a backlash among many Democratic lawmakers, congressional aides said. On February 3rd, Dermer huddled with Senator Joe Manchin, a West Virginia Democrat, who said he told Dermer it was a breach of protocol for Netanyahu to accept an invitation from Boehner without going through the White House. Manchin said he told Dermer he would attend the Prime Minister's speech to Congress, but he was noncommittal about supporting any move by Congress to block a deal. Dermer spent the following day doing damage control with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a New York Democrat, congressional aide said. 2 days later, Dermer met with Dianne Feinstein of California, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, at her Washington, D.C. home. He pressed her for support because he knew that she, too, was angry about Netanyahu's planned appearance. Feinstein said afterwards she would oppose legislation. God dang it. Allowing Congress to vote down an agreement. Almost done. Wall Street Journal today. Israel spied on Iran talks. Back in a sec. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys. Last three paragraphs of this thing. Holding over to the third segment here. I know, it's not the best radio to read the Wall Street Journal for an hour, but god dang it. Feinstein said afterwards she would still oppose legislation allowing Congress to vote down an agreement. This is from Israel spied on Iran talks in the Wall Street Journal today. Congressional aides and Israeli officials now say Israel's coalition in Congress is short the votes needed to pass legislation that could overcome a presidential veto, although that could change. In response, Israeli officials said Netanyahu was pursuing other ways to pressure the White House. This week, Netanyahu sent a delegation to France, which has been more closely aligned with Israel on the nuclear talks, and which could throw obstacles in Obama's way before a deal is signed. Those treacherous, ungrateful... Is there anyone... The Obama administration, meanwhile, is stepping up its outreach to Paris to blunt the Israeli push. If you're wondering whether something serious has shifted here, the answer is yes, a senior U.S. official said. These things leave scars. In other words, they hate Netanyahu as well. They should, as all decent human beings do, because he is among the least decent of human beings on this planet. The treacherous, treasonous Israelis. Oh, they're our best ally in the Middle East. It's that no one can name a single thing they've ever done for America, ever. Oh, they're the only democracy in the Middle East, except half the people that they rule under totalitarian martial law have no right to vote whatsoever. Oh, they're Western civilization, except that, no, actually, they're mostly from Eastern Europe and from the Middle East, and they outright reject the theory that all men are created equal. There's the Israeli Jews, and then there's everyone else. As Netanyahu made very clear just last week, the Arab, Israeli, Christians, and Muslims who are Israeli citizens are enemy aliens marching on the ballot boxes if we don't stop them. Nothing good that they say about Israel is true at all, other than it's on the Mediterranean Sea, and the Mediterranean Sea is pretty. But anyway, when it comes to America bending over backwards to protect Israel, it's never good enough. The theory, the scam that Obama is seeking a bad deal here, I mean, you can tell they're lying just on how simple and stupid that is. A bad deal, huh? Well, what does that mean? A bad deal means one where Iran is allowed, quote unquote, by people who have no legitimate authority over them whatsoever, to maintain a civilian nuclear program whatsoever. If Iran is allowed to maintain a civilian nuclear program, then that is a bad deal. Except, nobody has a better solution other than, as Joshua Muravchik put it, bomb them and keep bombing them forever. And if bombing them makes them decide that I guess they do need to start making nuclear weapons now, which they have not decided to do, then we'll just have to keep bombing them and bombing them and bombing them. That's what he wrote in the Wall Street Journal. I mean, in the Washington Post 2 weeks ago. Joshua Muravchik. War with Iran is probably the best option, he said. And when it backfires, well, we'll just have to keep bombing them and bombing them and bombing them. But here's Josh Block, the former spokesman for AIPAC, the still current de facto spokesman for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which ought to be called the Israel Public Affairs Committee. There's nothing American about it other than it's located here. And he says, what does the proposed White House deal to give Iran everything it needs to build nukes mean for you? It means that you're a stupid liar. Is it impossible for an Israeli or one of their sock puppets to say a thing that's true ever? What would happen to them? They spontaneously combust and die and burn and go to hell and burn forever if they say something true ever? The White House deal has nothing to do with giving Iran anything. They bought centrifuges from AQ Khan back 15 years ago. They already have a Natanz facility full of spinning centrifuges, Josh Block. And they didn't get them from Barack Obama. And by the way, spinning centrifuges is not everything they need to build nuclear weapons. Not by a long shot. And of course, the nuclear deal is entirely based on expanded inspections, reduced stockpiles of uranium, which still are only being to be enriched to a measly 3.6% uranium-235, which is good enough for their electricity reactors, and yet far short of the 94% pure uranium-235 that they would need to make a single gun-type nuke. And the whole thing is just a damn lie. And that's why the Iranians have been so willing to negotiate this. Their only sticking point is lifting the sanctions. And yes, they're not going to give up their entire nuclear program. But as far as their willingness to basically damn near break their spine, bending over backwards in order to prove beyond any shadow of a doubt that they are not making weapons and that they have no intention to make weapons, they've agreed to all of that. To all of that. The only thing that people, those opposed to this deal, have to say against the deal are all lies. They're all lies, or, you know, outright lies, like Josh Block here, the liar. Or it's a lie by omission, that somehow there's a better alternative. That somehow there would be a good deal if the Republicans were in power. But of course, George Bush and Dick Cheney refused to negotiate with Iran back before they had a single spinning centrifuge, back when they offered to bend over and completely take it in 2003. And they refused to talk to him. And when the Europeans were negotiating on their behalf for 3 years, and the Iranians adopted an additional protocol to their safeguards agreement, allowing for expanded inspections by the IAEA, the deal eventually fell apart because the European Union could not, well, the E3, that's Britain, France, and Germany, could not negotiate in good faith on our behalf because the Americans wouldn't participate and the Americans didn't have any good faith. The deal was going nowhere, so they dropped the additional protocol. They still haven't done anything to build nuclear weapons or to advance any kind of nuclear weapons program whatsoever. It just ain't true. And the only alternative that the war party can propose here is war. You send your son to die for Israel because Israel feels uncomfortable with the civilian nuclear electricity program. Yeah, sorry about your tiny, pathetic little female emotions, Israel, but I'm not sure why we should care about how concerned you are. And then you see what treacherous people they are, the Netanyahu regime here, the Likud regime in Israel. Israeli delegation heads to France ahead of final round of Iran nuclear talks, as mentioned in that Wall Street Journal piece. Well, we bought and paid for all of the U.S. Congress, and it wasn't quite good enough. So let's go and activate every asset we have inside the French government and see if we can get them to scuttle the deal instead. Because America doing everything to guarantee the civilian nature of Iran's nuclear program ain't good enough. Because as Scott Ritter wrote in his book Target Iran back 10 years ago or so, to the Israelis, a nuclear program of any description in Iran is tantamount to a nuclear weapons program. Meaning, it's not, but they like to pretend that it is. That's all. That's all. And now, one more positive thing to say about these Iran talks and everything that's going on here before we head out to this break. And I got a ton of more news on all different subjects to cover with you in the next hour. But to end this on a positive note, the politics now, I believe, are such that Obama must succeed. He must be able to announce a deal, he and Kerry, at the end of this month, that they have a deal. And now maybe they could put it off again, but if they put it off again, that's going to be really bad politics. That's going to leave a huge opening for more treachery by the Israelis and their fifth column inside the United States to scuttle these talks. And Obama just put out a new YouTube to the Iranian people saying, come on, man, let's do this. It's a historic opportunity. I believe that he really means to do it for his own reasons, but it's the right thing to do, and he deserves our support on this only. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Wharton. This is my show, Scott Wharton Show. I'm going to talk to you about Ukraine here in just a sec, but I want to cover some police state stuff here real quick. I got a ton of it to go through with you here. But first of all, in the police state section, I want to talk about Mike Brown for a second. It's going around that, oh, well, the feds have proved that Mike Brown was guilty and deserved to die, and that poor Darren Wilson was being attacked, and that all the witnesses who said otherwise were lying and all this stuff. And yet, I don't think that that's the case at all. I don't see any reason to believe that whatsoever. You know, they say, for example, that the fact that Mike Brown's DNA was in the cop's car, I guess even on the gun, was proof that, well, Mike Brown was trying to murder the cop. But of course, all that proves is that the cop drew his gun and that Mike Brown grabbed it in an attempt to defend himself, in an attempt to not get shot to death by this cop who had driven up and picked a fight with him for no reason. That doesn't prove that he deserved to die. Someone, even a government employee with a holy writ from baby Jesus to murder whoever he wants, pulls a gun on you, you have, for no good reason, not in defense of his life, pulls a gun, then it's assault to, it's attempted murder to try to grab that gun and prevent it from being used, and the cop fired it twice. So he took off running. And then all the evidence is that the cop fired 12 shots, 6 of which hit Mike Brown. Well, doesn't that sound to you like the plausible explanation for why he stopped and turned around, not 35 feet away, but 150 feet away, he stopped and turned and with his hands up, according to, well, I don't know, I guess it's not 16 witnesses anymore because some of them did admit that, well, I kind of heard that in the crowd and I don't know. But there were definitely some witnesses, like the repairmen, who said that they, you know, the contractors who were there, who saw him turn around with his hands up. The way his friend explain the story, and there was a great write-up at stupidvox.com where they compared and contrasted the cop's version of the story with Mike Brown's friend's version of the story. And the two stories track as far as step-by-step what happened, except that Darren Wilson's story doesn't make any sense whatsoever as far as the details, and the friend's story is completely plausible. It's absolutely plausible. The cop was shooting at him, and people said they shot him in the back. He shot him in the back. Well, they assumed that because the cop was shooting at him as he was running away. So Brown turned around to say, stop shooting, I'm unarmed. And then they say, oh, well, he took a couple of steps toward the cop. And then so now you're just supposed to believe that that meant that he was going to turn around and run 150 feet back to the cop, beat the poor man within an inch of his life and take his gun and kill him. And so the cop only had no choice except to shoot him 6 times, including in the head. What a bunch of crap. How could anyone believe that? It is so obvious that he was surrendering. And the person who said, oh, he balled up his fist, he was charging the cop like a football player, that lady was a liar. And the DA admitted he knew she was a liar when he put her on the stand to testify in front of the grand jury. She made the whole thing up. She wasn't even there at all. All media people agree now that, look, the Justice Department says that, well, geez, some of these witnesses are discredited and meh. So, therefore, Darren Wilson's story is completely correct. Even though, no, he's not. It's ridiculous. How could anyone believe that for a minute? Other than it confirms your bias. But oh boy, you watch on Fox News. Oh my God, what a travesty. Hands up, don't shoot. Never happened. Yeah, it did too. And just because Eric Holder says something doesn't make it true, Fox News. Did you know that? Oh, except when it confirms your bias. White cop kills black civilian. So it must be fine. Give me a break. This young man was walking down the street on Saturday or Sunday morning, way out of the way. It's not like it was a major thoroughfare or something. He might as well have been on the sidewalk when this cop drove up, picked a fight with him, and murdered him. It's as simple as that. So, anyway, I don't know how you people buy into this kind of crap. And by the way, here's one from this morning about Philadelphia. They did the Department of Justice did a report on the Philadelphia Police Department. It says that they shot 59 unarmed suspects. I'm not sure of the time frame here. 59 unarmed suspects, roughly 16% of the total number of people that they shot were unarmed. 45 of those unarmed suspects were black, the report found. And now, here's a point that I hardly ever hear anybody make but me, so I like to make it as often as I can. Just because a black man has a gun doesn't mean you can murder him. Black men are human beings, too. Black men have a natural, God-given, even if you believe in God, right to bear arms so that they can defend their life against anyone who is attempting to take it from them. So they can defend their life against anyone who is initiating deadly force against them. They've got just as much right as you, Judge Taney. You know that that's part of the Dred Scott decision? I swear to God, go look in the Dred Scott decision. And he says, Judge Taney says, Supreme Court Chief Justice Taney says, well, a black man can't have rights, can't be free, can't have rights that white men are bound to respect, because if he did, then that would imply that they have the right to bear arms. And I know you're not trying to say that black people have the right to bear arms, so therefore, no, that couldn't possibly be right. It's in there. Go read it yourself. In Dred Scott, the most disgraceful Supreme Court decision in American history. And said that no black man has a right that a white man is bound to respect. Because if he did, then that would mean they have the right to bear arms, which means that when we're trying to murder them, that they would have the right to shoot back. Go figure that. So, by all means, unarmed black guys being shot to death, that's a big story. But don't let them fool you that just because a black man has a gun, that means that he deserved to die. That implies that he was pointing it at the cop and was trying to kill the cop with the gun. Or was trying to kill someone else with the gun at the moment that the cop shot him. And you might understand that that's the only time it's okay to shoot somebody is in immediate and proportional self-defense or defense of another innocent life. Immediate and proportional. So, anyway. And now, well, one more thing about this while I'm on this. I half think that Black Lives Matter is a distraction, but only half. Because the thing is, it is about race. It's always been about race. Since before Dred Scott and ever since Dred Scott. It's been about race. When did it stop being about race? That government and mobs and whoever else kill black people and get away with it. Yes, it's about race to a great degree, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's about racism. Although, boy, did you see the cops in Florida and the video that they made and all the text messages and all them talking about giving N-words the death penalty early and all this stuff? Hey, boy, don't quote me too absolutely. Yeah, it is about racism, too. A lot. But what it's really about is black people don't have political power. Black people in America are much more likely to be poor and therefore have no political power. And so, therefore, the cops know that they can kill them and get away with it much easier than killing white guys in the suburbs. On the other hand, they kill white guys in the suburbs all the time, too. God damn it. Where's the bumper music on this motherfucker? In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, I got the monitor up nice and loud now. Jesus Christ. How many segments have I blown because I couldn't hear the bumper music so far in today's show? 3, 4? I'm talking up to... All of a sudden, there's commercials playing. There's some goddamn music, man. In the chat room, they say they can hear it, so it's all my fault for just having the monitor down too low. I don't wear headphones except during the interviews. I kind of have to, but otherwise, they hurt my ears, man, and I don't want to go deaf. Not yet. Anyway, what I was trying to say was, yes, it is about race, but what it's really about is impunity. So if we change the focus from the victims to the perpetrators for a minute, what is up with these cops? Well, they like murdering people. They like killing people. Any chance that they get to kill someone, they will take it. But what gives them a chance more than, well... What gives them a chance, oftentimes what factors into them having a chance, is the race of the suspect. The darker the skin, the easier it is for them to get away with killing somebody. And that's the truth of it. And really, they can get away with killing us all now. They can come and kill every person in your entire neighborhood and then say, oh, well, you know, he was reaching for his waistband and I got sovereign immunity anyway, and that'd be the end of that. They can kill whoever they feel like. But I understand, believe me, I understand why black people think of it as a racial issue, because they are much more likely to be murdered, you know, per capita and all of that. But I think if we're going to focus on trying to solve the problem, The focus needs to change from Black Lives Matter to police must be held accountable. Hashtag accountability for killer cops. Special prosecutors from outside jurisdictions for every homicide at the hands of law enforcement. Accountability. That's what's missing here. Accountability. And saying Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter, yeah, I mean, it's true. Okay, but you know what? Even a murderer cop would agree or pretend to agree that, yeah, of course Black Lives Matter. Judge Taney's been dead for a long time. Dred Scott was overruled a long time ago. Everyone agrees Black Lives Matter. Even the people who kill black people for fun with their shiny little costume jewelry badges on all day would tell you that Black Lives Matter. So I think that it's time to change that hashtag, man. It's time for the anti-police state activists to change it up, to focus on the real, well, not the real, but something like, something approaching a solution to the problem, which is accountability, an end to the doctrine of sovereign immunity, of qualified immunity for people who murder on behalf of the government. Oh, he was reaching for his waistband. You don't have the right to murder somebody just because they were reaching for their waistband. Let's see. If you shot a cop in the face and killed him and then said, but judge, he was reaching for his waistband, they would give you the death penalty. Reaching for his waistband. What the hell? Well, did he have a gun in his waistband? Could you see the barrel of it pointed at your eyeball hole? Then you don't have the right to kill somebody just because you claim he's reaching for his waistband. And of course, among poor black men, typically this style is low-hanging pants. So if somebody's running from a cop or even just trying to hand him his wallet, he might reach for his waistband, for his belt, just to pull up his pants a little bit as he's grabbing his wallet for you. That doesn't mean it's a lethal threat. Again, never even mind a cop. If you murdered your next-door neighbor, if you shot anyone to death and then used as your excuse waistband, you would go to prison. But if you're a government official, you could murder 100 people and go, oh, hey, I'm a cop. I can murder whoever I want. And the local DA will know, bill you. The grand jury will go, well, geez, I don't know. The DA doesn't seem to want to prosecute it, so I guess we don't either. And that'll be the end of that. And every other cop around will cheer and let him get away with it. Show me a cop who arrested another cop for committing a crime. Oh, come on, Scott. All cops aren't evil, bad murderers. Oh, yeah? Well, show me some good cops arresting their partner when he commits a crime. When he steals money. When he shoots somebody to death. For no good reason. Oh, sorry, bud. You just crossed the line. You're under arrest. Put your hands behind your back. That guy was not an immediate threat to you. Yeah, show me a single one of those, and then I'll believe your ridiculous lie about not all cops are bad. Yes, all cops are bad. Of course they are. Of course they are. The only reason anyone becomes a cop is so that they can kill people and get away with it. Because they're psychopathic killers, and they want, and they're smart enough to get a license to kill first. You know, it's funny, I remember asking my mom about James Bond and the license to kill when I was a little kid, and her explaining to me how that's a fiction. The government can't give someone a license to kill because the government doesn't have the right to kill. They don't have the right to kill anyone any more than anyone else does. The only time anyone has a right to kill is in defense of their own life. So the government doesn't have a right to kill, therefore they can't license their agents to have the right to kill. It's just a movie. It's just a story. In real life, the deputy sheriff doesn't have any authority that you don't have yourself, that you didn't delegate to him. Well, I have the right to protect my life up to and including with lethal force, and therefore I can delegate that authority to my security guard too.
You have the right to defend me, up to and including lethal force. That doesn't mean that how, in fact, could I possibly grant a sheriff, a deputy sheriff, power that I don't have? Right. Anyway, the question is one of accountability. Of course, Black Lives Matter. The question is one of accountability. And I see from time to time people proposing special prosecutors for killer cops, outside jurisdiction prosecutions for killer cops. As long as we have government security forces, that's as good as you're going to get as in terms of competition, is bringing in district attorneys from other counties in your state to come in and review these things, to even have a prayer at accountability for killer cops. And so that's why there's an epidemic of police murders across this country, is because they know that they will never, ever, 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 ever get in trouble for it. So who's to stop them? Why would they not kill someone if they have the slightest excuse? If that's all they want to do and they know for a fact that they will never, ever, ever be held accountable. See? You see how that works? It's the same reason why we see this epidemic of, I hear the bumper music this time, the epidemic of innocent people being freed from prison. Why are they in there? Because there's no accountability for judges and prosecutors and cops who lie people into prison. There's no accountability. And so they just keep on. You understand? Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all. One more police state story here real quick. NYPD is installing microphones throughout New York City in the name of triangulating the location of gunshots. But, of course, they'll be able to listen to your conversations, too. And this is something that the Supreme Court has ruled unconstitutional in the past. That's why the surveillance cameras out in public don't have microphones, typically speaking, because the theory is that if you're out walking around and anybody can see you out in public, you're on the commons, on the government-owned sidewalk or government-owned street, then, well, geez, it's not really a matter of your privacy or secrecy or whatever that that you are where you are. That's publicly available information for anyone to behold you. So if they want to put a camera on you too, then that's okay. However, if you're walking on the sidewalk and you're having a private conversation with your friend, then you do have an expectation of privacy there. And so no microphones allowed. Well, I guess those days are over, at least in New York City. They're going to go hog wild with these so-called gunshot microphones that, of course, will be useful for spying on people as well. So take a look at that. And by the way, for all of your most horrible police state news, check out libertycrier.com. Oh, I got to tell you this one, too. Woman held for 8 days in New York City psych ward for saying that Obama followed her on Twitter. He does. And what happened was she was upset because they towed her car. So she went to get her car back and she was upset. And so they had her locked up in a psychiatric hospital. I look at this. They handcuffed her and sent her to the hospital, saying she was emotionally disturbed. According to the lawsuit she's filing, quote, "The next thing you know, police held on to me. The doctor stuck me with a needle and I was knocked out. I woke up to them taking off my underwear and then went out again. I woke up the next day in a hospital robe." She said she was heavily sedated by hospital employees and told the New York Daily News she only mentioned to doctors that the president follows her on Twitter to show them, quote, the type of person I am. I'm a good person, a positive person. Obama follows positive people. Instead, the lawsuit alleges the doctor made her discharge contingent upon her denying that Obama follows her on Twitter. According to her, quote, master treatment plan, one of the objectives that would trigger her release was that she would state that Obama is not following her on Twitter. No one at the hospital, she said, checked her Twitter account for objective proof of the truth of her claim. She's trying to get back a measly $13,000. She ought to be suing them for $100 million. And that cop ought to be beaten within it. I mean, the doctors at that hospital ought to be beaten within inches of their lives. They ought to be, okay, no, they should. They should have to go to prison for 10 years for kidnapping. Are you kidding me? Oh, no, they have sovereign immunity to kidnap and torture and semi-rape and do whatever they want with whoever they want, right? They have a license to kill granted to them by the government. They have sovereign immunity to kidnap people. And then, oh yes, the measure of her insanity is that she said that the president follows her on Twitter. When all you gotta do is log into her account, click on Barack Obama, and see if it says follows you or not. What a crazy woman. And again, she's a black lady. Now, I guess they probably would do this to white people too, but I think typically they figure that they can get away with doing whatever the hell they want to a black woman, whereas if it was a white woman that they were kidnapping, they might have to wonder, uh-oh, is it possible that she's the niece of some congressman? Is it possible that she knows somebody who could get me in trouble? But hey, she's black, so what are the chances of that? It's amazing. America is like the Soviet Union now. It is just so freaking out of control. It's unbelievable. And again, there's a simple answer to all this. There's no accountability for government employees and their agents, their deputies, their assets. There's no accountability. So they commit crimes against innocent people all day, every day. Because there's no accountability. All right. By the way, brand new Seymour Hersh on the My Lai Massacre, the scene of the crime, a reporter's journey to My Lai and the secrets of the past. Wow. Haven't read it yet, but just so you know, brand new at the New Yorker. Letter from Vietnam. Seymour Hersh, of course, the heroic journalist who broke that story way back when. Okay, so now I finally get to Ukraine news. I got more news for you here, too. Oh, man, I wanted to talk. No, you know what? We're going to do Ukraine in the last segment. I want to talk about Israel-Palestine. Not Israel-Iran, but Israel-Palestine. Top Obama aide. Israel must end occupation. Quote, occupation that has lasted for 50 years must end. End quote. From the White House Chief of Staff, Dennis McDonough. And why didn't he just spell his name right and then we can call him Donahue? Is it Dono? Is that how you're supposed to say it? McDonough? Anyway, 50 years. That's longer than the USSR occupied Eastern Europe. The Israelis have been occupying the helots of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. Millions of people. With the split between the Obama administration and the Israeli government, between the Obama administration and the Israeli government has been a top story for a while, White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough recently raised eyebrows with an explicit call for Israel to end its military occupation of Palestine. An occupation that has lasted for 50 years must end, McDonough said at the liberal Israeli lobby J Street's annual conference. It's not a dramatic official policy shift, as the U.S. has supported the two-state solution, at least on paper, for a long time. Still and all, I love the way Jason writes, still and all, it's not the sort of thing U.S. officials would say in such a pointed manner,
let alone at such a venue as J Street. Let alone at such a venue as J Street has clashed openly with the Netanyahu government. It's a tit-for-tat move, a sign of U.S. displeasure that the Israeli premier openly denounced the two-state solution in a last-minute campaign last week. Netanyahu has since tried to backtrack, though McDonnell said it was clear that the U.S. cannot simply pretend these comments were never made. That's right. When Netanyahu says, when he said in the first place that he supported a two-state solution, he was lying. And when he said he did not support a two-state solution, he was telling the truth. And then when he said, no, I didn't mean that, I do support the two-state solution again, he was lying again. And you would have to be the damnedest of damned fools to interpret that any other way, seriously. If you thought, if you think that Obama means, well, anyway, I don't want to finish that sentence the way I was going to finish it. But this is a big deal, and they brought James Baker over there, who told his own story of trying to get Yitzhak Shamir to back off on all the settlement expansion on the West Bank back in 1990-91, which led to the ouster of George H.W. Bush from power. You thought it was the economy, stupid. It wasn't. It was the Israelis and the Israeli lobby. And they all got behind Bill Clinton in order to punish George H.W. Bush for having the temerity to suggest that America would withhold its massive multi-billion dollar welfare payments to Israel if they wouldn't stop expanding the settlements, the purpose of which, of course, is to prevent even the possibility of the creation of a contiguous Palestinian state on the West Bank. And so I thought that was interesting that Baker decided to show up just to jump into this thing. And but anyway, I'm not saying anything big is going to change here, but other than the narrative, I think the narrative is now undeniable. And I don't know whether things are going to get better or worse now, but at least the lie that the Israelis ever meant to abide by Oslo or anything like it is over now. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me. The social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, you know what? I'm really not quite done with Israel-Palestine yet. I'm going to switch to Ukraine in just a second. But first of all, I wanted to mention here about all this talk at the J Street Conference, etc. Has been, and I'm more or less plagiarizing Rania Kalik here, I think, from a couple of her tweets the other day, where... You know, Netanyahu, supposedly is apologizing. He said he regretted it. He didn't really apologize. But he said he regretted his horrible racist statements that, oh, no, all the Israeli Arabs are coming out to vote. So right-wingers, hurry, we got to stop them and all this kind of thing. And yet, even the people who are criticizing him are saying, well, like Dono is saying here, that Israel must give up the West Bank. They must embrace the two-state solution, or else what? Or else it will be a one state between the river and the sea, and then the Israeli state, it would be an apartheid state for a short time until that just completely falls apart, and they have to end up giving the vote to the Arabs, and then at that point... Israel would lose its Jewish character. At this point, it cannot be a Jewish democracy anymore. It's either Jewish or it's a democracy, but it can't be both unless they give up the West Bank. And we're supposed to think that that's the catastrophe. That, that this racist state, and mostly racist, it's a sectarian thing too and whatever, but it's mostly a racial thing, that would be the greatest travesty. Now, you know, if Arabs got to vote for the Knesset, if the occupied Palestinians got to vote for the legislature there and had their say in the government. Now, how is that actually different than what Netanyahu said about the Arabs must be stopped? It's the same thing, isn't it? Now, it's not really, I don't really have an opinion one way or the other as far as a one-state solution or a two-state solution necessarily, because I'm a libertarian. I don't believe that there should be a state at all. Why can't property rights be the only borders in Palestine? Why should there have to be a government there at all? I think probably what makes most sense for the Palestinians who've been deprived of their human rights for generations on end now would probably be a Palestinian state, except that does anyone believe they could ever have a real state as opposed to some horrible rump type ridiculous thing like that Netanyahu used to describe when he was pretending to be in favor of a second state at all? I don't know. But if it's really a one state solution, an outright apartheid where the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza are just annexed and they are officially part of Israel, and yet with a good, at least half the population deprived of the ability to participate in the government in a blatant, undeniable apartheid type system, then I think probably what would happen, what was more likely to happen than a South Africa type solution where a de Klerk says, okay, come on in and vote. And hey, if you guys are the majority now and win, then I guess that's fine and whatever. I think rather than that, what's most likely is I think the Israelis would just murder as many Palestinians as they possibly could, even by the millions. I think they'd be more than happy to do another Nakba where, remember, in 1948, they killed 750,000 people. 750,000 people. And I think they'd be perfectly happy to do that again. Just bomb Hebron off the face of the earth. Just bomb the Gazans, carpet bomb them all the way to death until they're all dead. Or maybe in place of that, do an Andrew Jackson style and just force march them into the Sinai Desert or into the Jordan River. Because I think principle one of the Israeli state is they must maintain their super duper 80-20 majority over the Palestinians. And I think that there is no upper limit on the number of children they're willing to murder in order to make sure that it stays that way. So in that sense, I think probably what would be best for the Palestinians would be a two-state solution rather than a one-state. And yet Oslo's been dead. You can watch the footage of Netanyahu now 14 years ago bragging that he killed Oslo, that he held Bill Clinton down and effed him right in the face and said, oh yeah, whatever you say, Bill Clinton, we're negotiating. While what he was really doing was not negotiating. What he was really doing was sabotaging everything. And boy, were they great at that PR narrative that Arafat had such a great deal and then gave it all up. When in fact what they gave him was a piece of crap deal he couldn't possibly accept. And it was Netanyahu that killed Oslo back in the 1990s, and it's been dead since then. And so it's a hell of a situation, man. I don't know what's going to happen. You know, I think that they need a no-state solution over there. But barring that, I really don't know what's best. But I think everybody now is in between a rock and a hard place over there. At least the lie that the Israelis mean well or mean what they say is completely debunked now. I mean, when they say something positive, we all know it's a perfect lie. And when they admit that their goal is simply to kill and steal as many as they need to steal as much as they can, how about that? That we can take that to the bank. All right.
What time is it?
All right, last few minutes here on the great Dan Sanchez from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Sorry, the Ludwig von Mises Institute at Mises.org. He's got this great piece. It's at Medium.com, and it's the spotlight today on Antiwar.com. Why Ron Paul is right about Ukraine. And he's talking about these pseudo-libertarians who are always trying to attack Ron Paul, and for that matter, me and Justin and Dan McAdams and anyone who is factual about the coup d'etat and the aftermath from last February, or not February before last, 2014. And, oh, you, Ron Paul, how come you're the servant of Vladimir Putin? All right, well, you're a bunch of idiots. And then now, so here is Dan Sanchez explaining why Ron Paul is right about Ukraine and how being right about Ukraine doesn't make you a puppet of Putin any more than Jacob Hornberger was a puppet of Salvador Allende, or any more than Ron Paul was the servant of Saddam Hussein, or probably any of these same damn libertarians were servants of Muammar Gaddafi back in 2011, when surely they opposed that, right? Obama's war to get rid of Gaddafi? You servants of Gaddafi? Give me a break. Ron Paul serves peace and the truth, and that's it. And that's why he's right about Ukraine. And I saw last night, I was talking with Dan Sanchez, and he was showing me some of the comments on his Facebook page from some of these Eastern European libertarians, quote-unquote libertarians, attacking him. And then what are their attacks? You love Putin. You repeat what Putin says. Well, God damn it, he just debunked the entire crap out of that phony argument in the article. That's what the argument is. That's what the article is about. Now, were any of these kooks able to challenge a single fact? Did they deny the right sector and the Svoboda Party National Socialists, Hitler-loving Banderist Nazis overthrew the government? No, they don't deny that. They can't. Do they deny that Victoria Nuland, Robert Kagan's wife, was busted 2 weeks, 3 weeks before the coup, well, 4 or 5 weeks before the coup, plotting the coup, that the audio of her phone call was leaked online, and that then the coup took place exactly as she described it? And the people that she and Jeffrey Pyatt, that she was on the phone with, the ambassador to Ukraine, that they were deciding ought to be the agents of the new government, came to power immediately to run the new government? Do they deny that the super-duper-looper majority of Crimeans wanted to join Russia, and that not a single person was killed in Crimea? Not a single person? They can't deny any of Dan Sanchez's facts, because they have none, because they're the tools of Robert Kagan's wife. That's all they are. Pathetic tools of Robert Kagan's wife. Ah.